Boom, what is happening, beautiful people? My name is Jack Nagel and welcome to another show of the Real Drug Talk podcast. On this podcast, we talk about all things alcohol and drugs, addiction, addiction recovery, and anything else interesting in the space. Hey, we're back after being away for a week. Sorry, I got crook for like a week and a half and just totally wiped out everything. Before I tell you about today's show, as always, this podcast is brought to you by our outpatient program called Connection-Based Living, where we show people how to beat addictive patterns without having to go to rehab. So if that's of interest to you, you can click on the links below, book in a free chat and consultation. And we can have a conversation about how we might be able to help or, you know, the best option for you and point you in the right direction. So that's Connection-Based Living. Check out the links in the show description. You can book in a free chat and, explore your options a little bit. So in today's show, we've actually got round two with Shane Cuthbert. So his first episode, which time flies, it feels like I just did that episode with him the other day, but it was actually at the end of last year. That's been one of the more popular episodes on the podcast. And today we just dive a little bit deeper on Shane's story. So for everybody listening, trigger warning, tread with caution if you have experienced trauma, if you've experienced trauma in the justice system or in the prison system, maybe this is one where you just kind of tread carefully, because Shane has a pretty full on sad, story, with his time in custody and what happened to him. So, he talks a lot about that in this podcast and then some things that he's trying to do, to help reform the justice system as well. So yeah, just a powerful episode, but just a trigger warning for everyone as well, because it's quite, intense, some aspects of his story. And there is some trauma that's shared there. So, hope you guys enjoy the show. Hope everybody is, well into their year and is going to have a really good Easter. We're on the mend now, so we're slowly just firing up the social media channels again. So be sure to check us out there and give us a follow and a like and subscribe and all that good stuff. Enjoy your week, everybody, and enjoy the show. Peace. Boom. What's happening, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Real Drug Talk. Look, we've got round two today with Shane Cuthbert. So how long ago was it? It feels like not that long ago, but I actually think it was quite a few weeks ago. We've just had lots of social media videos and stuff like that. Yeah. How long ago was it that you were on?
It was last year.
It was last year.
Like December. I'm sure it was December-ish. Yeah.
How crazy is that? Well, time flies. It feels like just the other day.
Yeah.
So we got Shane Cuthbert on the show, which is exciting. And I want to talk to you specifically about, a bit more about your story, just like in the criminal justice system. I know we touched on it a little last time we spoke, but it's such a massive story. And probably just a bit of like a warning for people, reach out to someone if you're triggered and all that stuff, because your story is like intense. But it kind of sets up really well for this stuff that you're advocating for at the moment with, some of the prisons that are going on and happening in Queensland and things like that. So, do you mind talking about some of that stuff today? I don't know. Do you get pretty open with it?
I am. Yeah. And, I think it's good for anyone listening too, to know that the more I actually share my story, the easier it becomes. The moment when you first open up and you speak to someone, it feels like a massive weight lifted.
Yeah.
It's still painful. It still hurts.
Yeah.
But I find that the more I share my story, the more it becomes more like a story, and less, I have less emotion attached to it.
Yeah.
So that's a positive thing. I mean, we really call it disassociating. You just disassociate from it, but it's easier to do when you're not keeping it inside, you know, when you let it go. So I love talking about it, and it helps a lot of people. And I've had a lot of people reach out to me recently. I actually put some hectic stuff on my Instagram story yesterday. I put a whole bunch of trigger warnings on there. I was going through some old photos that I had. I had like an old hard drive of photos, and on there I had some photos taken during the time that I was in prison. So I had this photo of me as really like a young early 20s guy, you know, the first time I went into prison. And we spoke about this last year. You know, I was suicidal at the time. I'd tried to hang myself in a tree. The branch broke. I had a broken leg. That's when I was picked up by police and taken to prison. And you look at that photo, and I'm clean shaven, and I look young, and I look stunned. Like I think my eyes look like, you know, where am I? Like, what am I doing here? And, you know, I just found myself looking at that for like 10 minutes, and I was like, wow. And then I just started, all the memories and things started coming back, you know what I mean? Like how I felt at that time. And I was scared, but also I wanted to end my life at that time anyway. And going to prison when you already wanted to end your life, it's like, you know what I mean? It's not like things are looking up for you. It's like, hey, I already wanted to end my life, and it's just getting worse. And crazy thing is in prison, I did not have a good time. I had a particularly horrible time, and it did. It just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I don't know how I made it through, but I did. And you know, just to set the scene, I went in, obviously, I was suicidal. Anyway, so I was in a dress. I was in an anti-suicide gown because they were keeping me in a watch house police station cell, you know, until I could get to prison. And I was there for about 2 weeks, and I was in and out of hospital because every time, you know, they'd give me a plastic spoon or a juice container, I was trying to work out a way to use that to, you know, cut my wrists or end my life. And I had this lady, the first lady during that 2 weeks, she was a sergeant at the Mackay Watch House. And she just sat down with me and got down on my level. She was the first person that I felt gave a fuck. And it wasn't much of a fuck. It was, she just sat down and just said, look, I know you're hurting. I know you don't want to be here, and life's not great right now. And she said, look, I've got you on the prison truck tomorrow. And I'm like, oh my God, son, I'm going to prison. But she was like, look, if you can just hang on one night, one more night, she goes, look, just trust me. You'll be taken to prison. And she said, I know it sounds bad, but there's people there that can help you. You know, you're going to have psychologists, you're going to have counseling and all sorts of stuff, right? And I did. So the next day I went on the prison truck, and I went to, it was Rockhampton Prison. I was in a, still in the anti-suicide gown. And I went in there, and there's a couple, we call them screws, the corrective services officers there. And what happens when you first come in is, you know, you got to strip off, and they put you in a shower, and then you come out of the shower basically naked, and they do a sort of a search just to make sure you don't have anything. The first thing they did was this officer, I still remember it now, he goes, man, you're all over the media, so you're going straight to protection. You're high profile. He's a razor blade. You know, finish yourself off in the shower. And so I did. I went in the shower with these razor blades, and I was like, "Yep."
The guard said that to you.
And this was common. This was not just a once off for me. I found that some of the guards, man, were worse than the prisoners. I actually recently, in the last couple of weeks, I've gone some of my videos on TikTok have gone viral, and I had a comment yesterday, And I'm guessing it's from a corrective services officer, because the comment was like, yeah, we used to love fucking guys like you up, sort of thing. And I was like, man, like, it's just, I know how much damage that causes people. And I know that, you know, I guess the damage it did for me was very inward. I was hating myself more and become more depressed. But there's a lot of guys in there where their hate and their anger isn't inward. It's projected outward. Yeah. And that's when you get those guys that they're released and they're more violent. You know, they do crazier things than, you know, they did before they even went in there. And that's because that's how the system's designed. And some of the people working in it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how to fix that problem, but, you know, there's good and bad in everyone. I mean, I've met good corrective services officers as well. Nice people, you know, just there. It's just a job. But yes, some of them, they make your time harder. And this guy, he was just like, yep, here you go. You know, he knew I was suicidal. He knew I was in a dress. And it's a funny thing, because I don't know what stopped me then in that moment. In that moment, I think I was shocked. I think I wanted to find out what he was talking about. I also then had this, maybe like a bit of antisocial personality about me, where I thought, hang on a second. If I want to take my life, that's cool. That's my choice.
Yeah.
But don't you tell me to do it. And I sort of got a little bit like...
You still had the rebellion thing going, yeah.
Anyway, so I had a leg brace, because I had the broken leg, and I took the razor blades out of the razor, and I slipped them in my leg brace. And after that, you know, I got taken out and sat in a room with two psychologists and just broke down, you know. And they said, look, we can't put you in the prison. We're going to have to take you to, you know, medical unit. So it was an observation unit.
And this is the first, what happens, this is the first time that you went to prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then what happens is, I'm in a medical unit where, you know, what happened was, usually they lock you in there. You're in an anti-suicide gown. You don't have any bedding. You don't really have anything. The light's on 24/7, and guys will walk past every half an hour to come check on you. But there's cameras anyway in the cell. Yeah. So they always know what you're doing. Anyway, what happened was, because they couldn't find the razor blades and because I had a leg brace on, they legally couldn't take the leg brace off, you know, because if they took it off and it caused me more harm,
yeah,
maybe I could sue them or something. I wasn't thinking about that at the time, but. So what they did is they had two corrective services officers 24/7 round the clock sitting at the end of my bed for 2 weeks. And the reason they had two is if one had to go get lunch or one had to rotate or go to the toilet, there was another one there. So, I mean, the expense of that must have been crazy.
Yeah.
But I did 2 weeks like that, and I was not eating. I was starving myself. They ended up getting me on these like chocolate Nestle sort of up and go things.
Yeah.
And that was just sustaining me. Like, I lost a lot of weight, and I don't know why. After 2 weeks, I sort of thought, there's no way I'm going to be able to do anything here. Right. I need to get maybe to a unit. And then I started thinking at that point, I thought, maybe the grass is greener. Maybe things are looking up, like, from here, just being watched 24/7 with a light on 24/7, and I can go and have my own cell and stuff like that. But, you know, maybe things are looking up. Things aren't so bad. And so I did. I packed up. I went down to a unit, and I was there for 4 days.
Yep.
So 4 days in a protection unit. So you're meant to be protected. Protection units as well are, from my experience, because I've been in normal prison and I've been in protection, I think protection's worse. Protection is where all the rapists pedophiles, really sick, sadistic people are. So I think there's a lot more of that kind of thing happens in protection. But yeah, I was there for 4 days. That prison then said, look, we can't keep him here. We can't keep him safe here. So I was in solitary confinement there for about 2 months. And then they put me on a little private jet to private jet to Townsville. And what's funny about that is I put up a story about that a couple of weeks ago. I was getting off this private jet and I've got crutches. So it's a jet owned by QPS, Queensland Police, and Correctives must lease it as well. So this is how they get prisoners from prison to prison.
Yep.
Because up here, every prison's about 4 hours between each other.
Right.
So I'm coming down and there was just media everywhere. And I was like, oh my God, is that for me? And I looked over and right next to us was, he was the Prime Minister at the time, Scott Morrison. He pulled up in his big plane and he was coming down as well. So he's Scott Morrison with his like AFP security guys walking side by side. He's me on crutches with these corrective services side by side. And we're about 20 meters apart. And I just thought, that is such a crazy, what a difference of just a visual difference to see two people at complete opposite ends of life and society, you know, someone at the top and someone right down the bottom.
Yeah.
But it was in Townsville where I went and again, protection. And I was sold up with a guy who was a convicted rapist. He'd done time for that before. He was in there at that time for the manslaughter of his 3-month-old baby.
Yeah.
Quite sad, actually. I got out.
And just to put it in comparison, essentially just to kind of refresh everyone's memory, what were you in prison for? So you had like the mental health stuff going on. You had like some mild kind of like substance use issues.
Look, I was drinking a lot. I had a lot of things. I had, you know, a marriage that wasn't going well. I was away from a lot of friends and family, really just because of my behavior and because of my relationship. A lot of family didn't approve. And I felt really lonely, isolated. I was very depressed, very anxious. And I ended up having 11 charges.
Yep.
So it probably sounds like a lot to a lot of people, but in the grand scheme of things, it's really not. They were all really relatively not serious. The most serious charge I had was an evade police.
Yeah.
And look, that's you could get 6 months in prison for that. And I did 6 months in the end. Evade police, drink driving. That was my third drink driving. Breach of bail, resist arrest, trespassing. A few things that on their own I would have got fines, maybe a bit of community service for, but, you know, they were stacking up. You know, I had 11 and really what happened is I didn't get bail because I didn't have a bail address. Yeah. I had nowhere to go. I'd spoken to a homeless shelter and, you know, that wasn't suitable, I was told. So I had nowhere to go. So I wasn't refused bail. Couldn't apply for bail because I had no suitable address.
Yeah. And that's the point that I want to make just before you kind of tell the next bit of the story. You know, someone on there with like kind of minor charges that you can quite easily just look at what's going on for you in terms of mental health, substance use issues, all that kind of thing, and kind of see why their life is manifesting in these sort of in these small charges. Again, not diminishing it. Anything, but yeah, and then you're put in a cell with a rapist and a guy that's killed his 3 month, you know, year old daughter. Like, it's crazy, man. That's crazy.
Yeah, you know, it is, and you know, there's a lot of guys that are remanded in custody that are in similar situations where they're just doing it tough outside. There's guys like for a lot of things. So there's a lot of homeless guys in there that they were drinking in the streets, or, you know, they were stole some things from Woolworths, or, you know, things that aren't really that serious, and they're charged. The police have refused their bail, you know, and then the court says, okay, well, what's your bail address? And I don't have one, I'm homeless. Or, yeah, or there's a lot of guys in there now with, so a lot of guys now with the new DV laws, where you get protection orders. And let's say you've had an argument with your wife. Let's say there was no violence, or anything like that. You've had an argument, the neighbors have called the police, and the police have said, look, we're going to put on a no contact order, basically, and just because, you know, we've got a duty of care. And, you know, so there's this guy now that's like, okay, so now I can't stay at home, I can't see my kids, I can't talk to my partner. And a lot of the time they're still talking and it's consensual, and then they have another argument, and then these guys, they end up in prison.
Yeah.
Then they lose their job. So you got guys in there now that are like, yeah, look, a couple of weeks ago, yes, you know, I had a family, I had, you know, a house, a mortgage. Now I've lost my job. And there's a lot of guys in there where, same situation, they didn't have another address.
Yeah.
You know, they might not have a mum or a dad or somewhere else to go, right? So they're in there and they're like, well, this order says that I can't go home, a home that I pay the mortgage for, or I pay the rent for. It doesn't matter. So there's guys then that have homes, but because of these domestic violence orders, can't go there. A lot of guys, and they're in jail for that. And you think, yeah, they're only going to get a fine anyway. Like, they haven't done anything really wrong. Obviously, those orders and those laws are brought in to protect people that are, you know, in dangerous situations.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, there's thousands that aren't.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that, you know, we could probably go into and talk about that needs to be looked at. But a lot of these guys, they're remanded in custody, not because they've done something really extreme or violent, or because they deserve to be in prison. It's just that they're in prison because they had nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
And I think that's sad. You know, when you think about that and you think, obviously I've been through that system now, and I've been in there and had terrible things happen to me. And I think, I see how I could have went the other way. I see how I could have come out and I could have been angry and I could have been worse or violent. You know, and a lot of guys go in there and they do think, oh, well, like, screw society. You know, yeah, if this is how they're going to treat me when I get out, what's the point of trying?
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of things there that we need to look at. But,
yeah,
you know, again, I'm in there for minor offences, really, on their own. Like, I mean, even being sentenced to 6 months in jail, I mean, for someone that's never been to jail, that sounds like a lot. But, you know, I get a lot of people now that have done a fair bit of jail that follow me and my story, and regularly get guys like, what the hell are you talking about? You only did 6 months. Like, you basically didn't even go to jail. Like, I mean, to those guys, they're like, who are you to share your story or our story? Yeah. I've done 26 years. You know, so it is what it is. And I could only speak about my experiences, but, you know, I'm in there for 6 months, and then I got celled up with this guy. He was a rapist. He was on remand at the time for the manslaughter of his child. And that was something pretty devastating. He got 10 years for that. In the end, he's probably going to be released soon.
Yeah.
I was in there in 2016. He'd already done a couple of years on remand. I think he was sentenced in 2019 to the 10 years, so he would have already had 7 or 8 served. And his child had 100 fractures that already started beginning to heal. He was someone I think did belong in prison. Actually, probably didn't even belong in prison, probably belonged somewhere where they couldn't even harm other prisoners.
Yeah.
Because this guy, you know, just absolutely, you know, tortured me. You know, it started with just, you know, a punch here and there. And he'd say, look, I'm toughening you up. You're weak. You know, I'm toughening you up. And, you know, for a while I was starting to believe it. He's like, look, this is jail. Like, you got to be tough. Like, and he just started bashing me up for no reason. And I was just putting up with it. And, used to happen a lot at night. I was on the bottom bunk because I had a broken leg and he was on top. And then, you know, I'd fall asleep and he'd come down and just beat me up. And then, you know, I got to the point where I was too scared to go to sleep. Like I was just, I had to wait until he went to sleep because I thought this guy's going to, you know, come down and beat me up in my sleep. And
yeah,
man, I was just at this point, I was so low. And I thought, there's nothing I can do. There's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to hide. I'm in prison. If I tell the guards what, it's going to be worse. And I'm going to have other guys trying to beat me up. And I only had a couple of weeks left. So I just put up with it. I thought, oh, look, I've got 2 weeks left. It's all good. I'll be out soon. You know, like trying to be hopeful. And it just got worse. And so one night, you know, I was sleeping and I actually did go to sleep and I was facing the wall and I had my back facing outways. So, you know, I thought that, look, if he comes down my face, everything's protected because I'm looking into the wall. But he raped me with a orange Colgate toothbrush with razor blades in it. We call it a shiv or like a prison knife.
Yeah.
And again, I still did not tell the guards. You know, I still didn't ask for help.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I think we talked about this last time. I went out into the yard the next day and you know, because I was screaming. I couldn't help it. You know, I was like, you know, like and crying out for help and no help was coming. But the guys in the yard were like, man, you gotta knock that screaming off, or like, you know, we're gonna jump on your head and bash you up, like we're trying to sleep. And I was like, this guy like raping me like with a knife. And they're like, you know, that's your problem, you know, like you sort it out. And I just remember feeling so like helpless then, like it was like this guy could have, like, if he wanted to, like he could have just killed me, like, and then that would have been it. Like there was no one to help me.
Yeah.
And you know, in the end, how he got called out was, you know, I got called up one day. It was buy up day, so once a week everyone fills out a form and they're allowed to get their chocolate bars and their cans of Coke and things like that, right? So if you've got family and friends sending money into the prison every week, you could buy food and chocolates and have a fun time. And
yeah,
I never did. I never had any money sent in. So I got $15 a week unemployment benefit. So for anyone in prison that, you know, they can't get a job, you know, cleaning the unit or working in some way, they'd get $15. And I was in there for 6 months and I just kept saving it up. And, you know, so I had a couple hundred bucks in there at that point. And this guy was like, oh, yep, give me a form. He filled it out, you know, was getting all this stuff coming, all these goodies coming. And that's all he was thinking about. And, you know, I got called up to go to the hospital to get an x-ray. And he goes, what was that about? And I was like, oh, I've just got to go get an x-ray on my leg. They want to see if the cast can come off. He's like, no, you go and tell them you're not going to hospital. I was like, oh, what? Why? He's like, you can't go to fucking hospital. It's buy up day. Like, you know, I'm getting this buy up. And I was like, yeah, no stress. You can have it. I don't care. You know, stop bashing me up and
just leave me torturing
me. Like, yeah, leave me alone. I could not care less about, like, take everything, anything you want. I don't care. Yeah. And anyway, he makes me go back up there. So I go back up there and I was like, oh, look, hey. So I'm talking to the corrective service officer. And I'm like, yeah, so I can't go to hospital today. And he's like, you're in jail. You do as you're told. What do you mean you can't go to hospital? I was like, oh, you know, I just can't go today. He's like, oh, so you don't want to go today? And I was like, yeah, no, not today. And he's like, well, you're going, like, bad luck. And I was like, oh, geez, okay, that didn't go well. And then I'm thinking, oh, man, I'm stressing out now because I'm like, oh, what's he going to say? He's going to bash me up now for that. And I went back. He goes, oh, yeah, what'd you say? And I, you know, I told him, and it's like, no, go back there. That's it. You're not going. And I was like, look, man, I don't think I can just not go. Like, You know, yep. they're going to come in, they're going to grab me, they're going to take me. Anyway, I went back up there again. I said, I can't go. And at this point, they're sort of like, what the hell is going on with this guy? Why can't he go? So they're watching me. And I go back and I said, yeah, look, mate, they said, I got to go. And he just started beating me up right there in front of him, didn't care.
Wow.
And then they pulled me out. You know, they pulled me out after that. And they said, oh, look, what's going on? And I said nothing, you know. And this is the worst because when I think about this, I think about how I said nothing. I think about how I was going through some of the worst trauma. It was the worst time of my life. You know, like I'd been sexually abused, physically abused, and I couldn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
I couldn't talk to somebody. I was dealing with this on my own. I was on my own. And that's the worst feeling. That upsets me more than the things that happened. The things that happened, I couldn't take them back. You know, shit happens, so to speak. But, you know, and especially in jail, you're very limited about what you can and can't do. But it was the not being able to talk to someone that really, really upsets me the most.
Yeah.
And it's a long walk. I'm on crutches and I've got to go to reception because that's where, you know, they'll strip search you again because they're going to take you to the hospital, make sure you've got no knives or anything, you know, so that you can't harm anyone in the public or at the hospital. So, you know, they strip search me and I'm just covered head to toe in bruises and cuts and things. And then they said, oh, look, what's going on? And I still just kept my mouth shut. And I just, in that moment though, like I lost my shit. I just started, you know, crying.
Yeah.
You know, and it just hit me and they're like, look, we'll talk about it when you get back. And I was just trying to keep such a brave face for so long. And people do this. It's not only in prison that people do this. I mean, people walk around every day that have their struggles and you don't know that they're struggling or they're hurting and they keep a brave face. But in prison, it's more so. Everyone's got their mask on. They're trying to be tough and no one wants to be weak and no one, you know, can cry and be soft and things like that. And
yeah.
That's really hard to deal with. And you know, yesterday I found another picture of that time, like after I'd been released. So after I'd been, you know, sexually abused and physically abused and tortured and all of that, and I got released and I grew a beard and I look at this photo and I look angry and I look hurt and I look like I'm going back into jail again, right? And I go, look at this guy. This guy, he's ready for it. He's got his mask on. And when I look at the two pictures and I compare them, and I did this yesterday, I was like, wow, look at how I was. And I can see the difference. And I'm like, you know, it's just incredible to see. It was a very hard time. And even for a long time afterwards, I didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, I've only just started sharing my story and talking about it in the last couple of months. I think the first podcast I did was with you. I've done a few more since and, you know, which has been great. It's been great for me. It's been, you know, healing for me. And yeah. When people reach out and they say, look, thanks so much. You helped me in some way, or that was incredible or inspirational. Like, you know, that really gives you a boost because when you've gone through trauma like that, you're not thinking that. You're not thinking, you know, say for me getting sexually assaulted in prison, wanting to end my own life, I didn't think that that was inspirational.
Yeah.
The inspiration, I think, comes later. When you have found your way through that trauma, that is inspirational.
Yeah.
Because people then that are still going through their trauma,
yeah,
they look at you and they go, wow, that, you know, it sort of just gives them that little bit of inspiration to think, you know, there's a little bit of hope there and you know, don't give up.
Yeah.
And I think that's such an important, powerful message.
And yeah. Mate, like, again, and for everybody listening, that's the thing that I just find insane. You know, like, yeah, thankfully you found your way through. But to think that, you know, you were subjected to these experiences and had that experience because you essentially, you know, were battling mental health and you were drinking too much and making bad decisions is fucking insane. Is insane. And I would say, and I don't know if you agree, from my experience, is that people that go through that process and maybe don't even have that extreme trauma that you had, but just go through the process, actually, as you said at the start, get worse and go more into criminality, right? Or get more intertwined in the system. Is that kind of the common story that you hear? Are you sort of an anomaly in that way that you kind of didn't, like I know you did actually re-engage in it quite a bit after that, but, you know, overall you come out of it. Yeah. Is that sort of like an anomaly? Yeah.
Look, it is. It's rare. There's not a lot of guys that do go through that and find their way. You got a lot of guys. Another guy that I follow, great guy I talk to him quite a bit, is Russell Manser. And he's someone that I look up to and helped me really find the courage to start sharing my own story. And, you know, Russ did 26 years in prison.
Yeah.
You know, it took him 26 years. And he talks about this a lot. There was a Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse. He was abused as a child, and that sent him on that path. And it wasn't until, you know, he got a little bit of money from that he was able to go and spend some time at a rehab and deal with that childhood trauma, where he was able to give up the drugs and change his life. So it took 26 years. I'm grateful it didn't take me 26 years, but I could see how people go down that path, especially, I think, when they were younger. You know, early 20s.
You're so confused when you're young, aren't you? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And look, you got a lot of other guys standing around and you're vulnerable. So you're listening to these guys that are in prison and they're all like, you know, be tough, act tough. And you start like, okay. And then, you know, if you spend a lot of time in that place, you start picking up your surroundings. I mean, I tell people all the time, like, you are the five people that you hang around with the most. Yeah. Imagine if the five people you were hanging around with day in, day out, living with, living in a unit with, sitting down at the table, having dinner with, is a rapist, a child abuser, and a murderer.
Yeah.
How do you think you're going to be when you've done 2 years of that and you get out in society and people are worse? And, you know, that's such an incredible way to look at it like that, because this is the environment you're putting people into and expecting them to be rehabilitated. And that's another thing I want to tell people too, is the courts. You know, I'm the president of my university's law society at the moment. I'm a member of all the law societies here in Queensland and go to functions and have beers now with magistrates, judges, prosecutors, and, you know, which is incredible considering my journey. But, you know, they tell me all the time, oh, look, like when they go to prison, they can get that support. And I said, I don't know who tells them this, but there's none there.
Yeah.
So for me, for example, I was remanded in custody. So when I did 6 months, I was in there for 4 months before I was sentenced. When you're on remand, you're not allowed to do any programs or courses.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. I really don't know why. But then by the time I was sentenced 4 months in and I had 2 months to go, they said, oh, no point doing any courses or programs because you've only got 2 months to go. So here I was. I'd done 6 months, gone through extreme trauma. I mean, some guys probably would have got out and would have been extremely violent and handled that in very different ways, would have hated the system and done some really, really bad things.
Yeah.
They would have been released after 6 months, having not done any courses, any programs, any mental health, anything to address substance abuse issues. And there's a lot of guys like that. There's a lot of guys I know that have done 12 months, even 2 years on remand, which by the time they get to court, they get time served and they're released. So imagine you've got a guy that's now spent 2 years in jail, but because he's been on remand that whole time, he hasn't done any courses or any programs.
Yeah.
He's released onto the streets the next day without having done any rehabilitative work at all.
Yeah.
And I tell people this and it shocks them because they do think that prisons are these wonderful places that have all these things and you'll get all this help and you'll get all this support, which just isn't the case. It's very, very limited.
Yeah.
Sadly, because, you know, I've seen it. I've got that lived experience. I've been to prison and I've made a lot of friends in there and I saw the paths that they took and I identified how they got on those paths. One of the most violent people I ever met, and I won't say his name, but man, he was terrifying. And he was a friend of mine. He took me under his wing, protected me for a long time. Now, this guy was set to play rugby union for Australia, right? He was incredible, incredible athlete. He was playing the under 19, so like the grade or the division below. And he went to a Korn concert, you know, like the metal band, years and years ago, and he got drunk and he fell down a set of stairs and he broke his leg. Now, he got addicted to pain prescription medications.
Yep.
And then after a while, because of his addiction and he couldn't get the scripts anymore, someone said, "Have you tried ice? Have you tried meth?" Wow. And he did. He started that. And then he was, you know, breaking into people's houses, stealing things, just trying to get, you know, meth addiction. And we see this all the time. This is not isolated. We see a lot of guys that, you know, they find a drug that they really, really like and there's no getting in between them, you know, and if they don't have that help and support early on, it's really difficult. And he was doing 6 years at that time for torture. Now, he tortured people. He was in a homeless men's shelter with another guy and they had sold some meth to one of the other homeless guys in there, but it was on tick. So the guy hadn't paid his bill yet.
Yeah.
They kept telling him, "You got to pay, you got to pay." He wouldn't pay. So one day, my friend, you know, seriously assaulted this homeless man in the homeless shelter. He still didn't pay. They let it go another week. And then what happened is the other guy dragged him into a room. My friend held this man down, this homeless man, and the other guy raped him.
Yeah.
Now, the homeless man went to the police after that. The police couldn't find any evidence of that because, you know, they could see that they went into the room together, but couldn't prove who it was or what happened. But what happened is they'd gone through all of the footage and they'd saw my mate assaulting this guy, you know, the week beforehand. And so he ended up getting, you know, his parole and stuff breached for that. But, you know, I remember him telling me this story like this was just another day. And I was thinking that, like, even though you didn't do it, you held this guy down. And this is like, that's some of the most extreme trauma. You know, guys that do that to people, it's just incredibly disturbing.
Yeah.
Those people do belong in prison. And I just felt so sorry for this homeless guy because this homeless guy, he was homeless. Okay. Yeah. He had obviously had some drug dependency issues. He'd used the drugs and couldn't afford to pay for them. And then, you know, and there's a lot of guys, I think, in that situation where a lot of guys in prison, they're in there because of the drug use.
Yeah.
You know, they're in there because, you know, there's a lot of guys serving really crazy sentences for, you know, going to service stations and holding them up with a screwdriver because that's armed. And dangerous and things like that. And, you know, these guys are doing 5 years, 7 years. That's a lot of time in custody, you know. And what did they get? They got $20, you know, or $30. They got enough for their next hit. And, you know, I see governments increasing prison time all the time. They think that it acts as a deterrent, and they always use that word, deterrent. This will act as a deterrent. This increase will act as a deterrent. I can tell you right now that when you want your next hit, you're not thinking about the deterrent. All you're thinking about is the next hit.
Yeah.
You couldn't care less. You know, these people that commit crimes, they're not, they don't, you know, they're crimes of desperation.
Yeah.
They're not thinking clearly because they're on drugs or they're under the influence of alcohol and, you know, substances. And they're not stopping to think, actually, hang on a second. If I do this, I'm going to go to prison. It does not even cross their mind. It acts as a deterrent for maybe people like you and me now that, you know, don't have those issues. You know, I'm not going to go to a service station and rob it now because I'm going to go, well, if I do that, I'm going to go back to prison. It's a traumatic place. I don't want to go there. I know what it's like. But again, I'm not going to go and rob the servo because I've got money in my wallet and food in my belly and, you know, I don't need to.
Yeah.
So I'm not committing those crimes because I'm not in that space. And there's a lot of people committing crimes and they're just desperate people.
Yeah.
It's a lot of them, you know.
It's so interesting, isn't it? It's like, it's amazing. And for everybody listening, I think everybody listening will pick this up. You know, we're not advocating that you can just do the wrong thing and get away from it. And that's, unfortunately, in the 3 minute snippets when this kind of conversation comes on media and stuff like that, where most people get their news from, is it's too hard to have the proper conversation because then some idiot will get on and just say, oh, so you're saying that people can just break the law and get away with it? And it's like, no, dickhead, that's not what I'm saying. But it is crazy when you, and stories like yours are like absolutely terrible, but so necessary for people to hear because, you know, if you just think like, okay, yeah, there has to be, I don't even like using the word punishment, but yeah, there has to be some sort of consequence to it. But like, why can't that intervention be something that actually helps people address their underlying issues and rehabilitate and not, you know, reoffend or not put them in a fucking cage and, you know, go crazy, like, you know, even more and do even worse things when they come out the other side, you know, it's just crazy that we do that to people. And just as an example for everybody, you know, like everybody can acknowledge, you know, we've got a rescue dog. And she was like traumatized and she's good with people, but when she sees other dogs, she's a bit, she's a bit hectic, right? You have to be on your guard because she's just not socialized and she doesn't attack them, but she gets into fights because she runs after them and stuff like that. Right. So like, it would be like taking animals that end up in the animal shelter. Right. And instead of doing what they do, which they could do better, by the way, but instead of like, you know, taking care of them and trying to find them a loving home and, you know, keeping them separated, feeding them, all that stuff, it would be like putting those traumatized dogs in a cage with each other, right? And letting them fucking fight each other. Like, you know, like that seems crazy to most people, but that's what we do with humans. Like, it's insane. It's fucking insane. Yeah.
You know, I think the narrative's starting to change as more people like me do speak out, because a lot of people do think that prisons are the places where these guys go to get help, you know, and the programs. I know certainly the judiciary, magistrates and things like that, they think, oh, look, no, there'll be mental health people in there and they're, and look, there is. I think they're extremely underfunded. I mean, most of the prisons I went to, they had a team, maybe 3 or 4 counselors or psychologists, right, for a prison that might have 1,000 inmates. And so if you'd asked to see one of these counselors or psychologists because you're having a bit of a tough day or, you know, you're worried about something, they'd more than likely see you the next day. And what they'd do is they'd come down and all they would do is an assessment, a risk assessment. Yeah. Are you at risk of harming yourself today? If you are, they'd go and put you in a padded cell. So there's no actual help and support there, even though you're reaching out. And then you get to the point where you're like, well, there's no point. There's no help. There's no support.
But like, even, mate, even if they had, don't you think, like, even if they had the most amazing funding and they had teams of psychologists and all that sort of stuff in there, you know, working with people and whatever. It's all bullshit because it kind of goes back to that, you know, that Rat Park that was experiment that was done in addiction. And, yep. you know, when the guy revisited it years later, he kind of went, well, hold on a second. Like, their environment's terrible. So, like, why don't we make this environment, yes. you know, with like Disneyland for mice, essentially. And
yeah.
then that's when they found the improvement. Like, you can't put people in, yeah, like a concrete cell. And then for anybody that's ever been, like, I've never been to prison, but obviously through work and friends visiting people, going in there to do assessments and stuff like that, like, it's fucking the most miserable place you've ever been to in your life. You know what I mean? Everybody, yeah. everybody yeah. looks the same. They got the same clothes on. Yeah, like, there's no way people are rehabilitating in a place like that, man.
yeah, no. Yeah. And you know what? It's going to take incredible guts and courage for politicians and those powers that be to make those changes, because it really is the narrative. I mean, I can see it now. You know, if you had some politician now that said, look, we're going to make jails these nice places to go, and we're going to rehabilitate people, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be, you know, outraged, saying, no, they don't deserve that. You know, they're prisoners. They belong in jail.
Yeah.
And it's that narrative we've really got to change.
Yeah.
And I know people that have gone to prison know that people, majority of people get out and they're worse. When I caught up with Deb Kilroy a couple of weeks ago, so she did, I think it was 8 years or something for drug trafficking in the 90s. She was at Boggo Road Prison, so a female prison. And at that time, if you were pregnant, you were allowed to give birth in the prison.
Yeah.
And you would raise your child, I think, to a certain age in prison. So there was all these women in there that had, you know, 4 and 5 year old kids. And she said, you know what was crazy is these kids, they'd turn 5 and then it was off to school. They'd never seen a school. They were too scared to leave the prison because the prison was all that they knew. So when the guards are like, okay, you're going off to school now, let's get in the car. They're like, what is a car? They were freaked out. They didn't know what a TV was. They didn't know what all these things were, and they were traumatized. Now get this. She said down in Brisbane, then a few years ago, they opened their Supermax prison for 12 of the most serious violent offenders in Queensland, basically, yeah. right? So this is super, super, super maximum security prison.
Yeah.
Of the 12 inmates, 8 of them had been those little children that grew up in Boggo Road jail with their moms in prison.
Wow. How crazy is that, man?
Yeah. There was a lady there at the time that was murdered. The kids saw that. You know, they saw a stabbing and a murder, and these are kids that are 3, 4 years old. And what's that saying when, you know, of our most violent offenders in the state, it's those that had early interactions with the system.
Yeah.
Incredible. Russell Manser was telling me as well about Grafton Prison. It was similar in New South Wales, where they sort of used to brutalise inmates. You know, they'd get them in there and the guards would bash them up and things like that. And he said it was after a few years that someone noticed, hey, a lot of these guys are coming out and becoming some of Australia's most violent murderers and serial killers. So a lot of our serial killers, the commonality was, hey, they all went to Grafton. What's going on there? And they sent these researchers in and started doing reports. I've been trying to get my hands on this report, because again, that's crazy. So when you treat people like this, they normalize it. They become very tough and cold, and you know, they dehuman. They think, yeah, exactly. And then you release them out into the world and expect them to be rehabilitated. It's actually, we're doing the opposite. We're making people worse.
Yeah.
And that's crazy. And I speak about this a lot now because up here where I live in Cairns, we've got a new youth detention center proposed.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Yeah, tell us about like what's going on where you are in Cairns. Yeah.
Yeah, so look, we've got a high youth crime problem. There's no doubt about that. Car thefts and break-and-enters are, you know, absolutely through the roof. And the government has, under pressure, released some of the most serious youth justice reforms that we've seen in Australia. And, you know, for example, they've got a new offence now for a young person that, you know, could be 12 or 13, breaks into a house and steals a car. You know, they can be sentenced up to 14 years in prison.
What?
And I know what 14 years in prison does.
But for if a youth does that.
Yes. So if you're under 18, you're a young person, you could be sentenced up to 14 years in prison. Now, I'm yet to see if any magistrates or judges actually do sentence any of these young kids to that. But, you know, that's
there will be. There fucking will be. There will be one spud that does it. You know, it's yeah.
And, you know, and people haven't liked me saying this. I've said this quite a few times. I said, you know, I get on the forums and Facebook and people say, yeah, lock them up for good. And, you know, and I've written comments and I've made videos where I've said, yeah, 14 years. Well, you can guarantee that young person's probably going to get out. And in 14 years' time, you've probably got a 14, 15-year-old daughter. That person might rape your daughter or murder your partner or something like that. And then they stop and they think, oh, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. I said, I know exactly what I'm talking about. I've seen it happen. There's research there. You know, there's just facts that prisons are not good. Yeah. But they're building another one where I'm at now to house all these young people that they're actually building two, one somewhere else and one where I live. So, you know, I'm against that because yeah, they're trying to, you know, tell us that it's going to be a holistic center. It's nothing holistic and beautiful and amazing about a youth detention center.
Yeah.
And again, these are young people. So these are young people. I think it has more of a negative effect on young people because they haven't started processing the world and their own headspace yet. So they get tossed into these situations and they're coming up, you know, they're fight or flight. And yeah. And a lot of them fight. Yeah. And that's not good because you get out and you're a fighter. And, you know, you see kids now that they get out there, they're ramming police cars and they're driving through the front doors of the police stations here. Like they've just got, yeah, they are out of control, but no one stopped to go, why? Yeah. No one stopped to say, how do we prevent this?
So this is another thing I... From your experience, why is that happening where you are in Cairns? Like what do you think some of the reasons are behind it?
Look, a lot of them have already spent time in custody, spent time in the watch house. They've had older brothers and sisters that have spent time in custody, the watch house, parents. You know, maybe they were 3 or 4 years old when the police come to take mum or dad away.
Yeah.
Maybe they were 3 or 4 years old when child services come and took them away and put them in a foster care home where they were sexually abused.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole bunch of things that can affect and negatively affect a young person, you know, in those developmental stages. A lot of these kids, they come from extremely traumatic backgrounds. Some of them, if they are with their parents, you know, they're out walking the streets at night because it's not safe at home.
Yeah.
You know, they might have parents that are under the influence of drugs and alcohol. And we call it intergenerational trauma now, especially when we're talking about Indigenous people. But that intergenerational trauma, it can happen to anybody because if you've been traumatized and then become a violent person and you're violent to your partner or your kids now have experienced violence and trauma and they are likely to grow up and do the same. So, you know, that's how this stuff, it's how it interchanges, really. You know, that's how it gets passed on. It's like knowledge, you know, and you pass something on to the next generation. Well, they're passing on violence, trauma, substance abuse, you know, mentality, hate the police, hate the system. And I don't blame them. You know, I've had some pretty terrible experiences. I was in a cell recently for being a public nuisance and the police later withdrew that. I was in town and I saw a group of Indigenous people about to fight in town. You know, I'd just come out of a club And I just had to intervene because I thought I didn't want to see these guys end up in prison. And I pulled both of them, two Indigenous guys, and they were, you know, basically in the middle of it, ready to fight. And I put myself in that situation. It was dangerous. They could have just started assaulting me. But I got in there and I took both of them and put my hands on their shoulders and I said, "Have you been to Lotus?" Now, Lotus is our local prison up here. And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Brother, you know, don't go back." And then I did the same to the other one. And then police arrived and I'm telling the police, no, they haven't fought yet. And then I get arrested for, you know, getting making the police guys' job harder. You know, and then I'm in the watch house and I get put in a cell with this elderly Indigenous man. Now, he's got to be in his 60s and he's having heart problems. And you've got an intercom in there. When you're experiencing heart problems or you need assistance, right? You talk to the intercom. The police are meant to come. They've got a duty of care, so to speak, apparently, and check on you and see how you're going. And I'm on this intercom because this guy's given up. And I'm like, "You got to come down here and look after this guy. Man, there's so many Aboriginal deaths in custody. And this is why, because the police just did not care at all." And I'm thinking, this is an old guy and he's in a lot of pain and he's rolling around and they're like, "Look, who are you? A humanitarian?" And I just said, "Yeah, maybe I am." And I kept hassling him. I kept banging on the doors for a good half an hour until they come by. And then you know what they did? They come in, they folded me up like a pretzel, you know, did that thing. It's a maneuver where they put your arm behind your back and it's just incredible pain. You know, it's not broken or anything, but you're just like, for the next 3 days, your arm is really, really sore.
Yeah.
Did that and took me out of there because I was a problem, because I was highlighting, you know, the things that they were doing that they weren't doing right. Then I'm in the cell next door and I can hear him. And this police officer goes in there later and I think, okay, finally he's getting some help. He's there in pain, you know, wriggling around on the floor. And this cop standing over him going, "Okay, look, let's just tell us what you stole. Tell us where it is." This guy's in need of serious medical attention. I mean, he could have been having a heart attack. I don't know. They didn't give him any medical attention. And the cops are standing over him and using that vulnerability to try and work out where he'd hidden whatever he'd allegedly stolen or something like that. And I was like, this is just disgusting. And it's little things like that that happen day in, day out, and they do. They do treat the Indigenous people worse. I don't necessarily think it's because they are Indigenous. I think there's maybe a little bit of a racism element. I think majority of it is a lot of the Indigenous that we have up here, they don't have very good English.
Yeah.
They can't read or write. They don't know how to make a complaint. They don't know how to sue the police. They don't have the support and the things people like us maybe have that go through that situation, and the police take advantage of it.
Yeah.
You know, that night, this fellow had a little bit of support, and that was me. That was someone that knew how to speak up. I could see what was going on. I could document it, and I have. And I could say, "Hey, this isn't right." And they folded me up, assaulted me, and took me away because I was too much trouble. And that's the reason I was there that night.
So how long ago was this? Was this when you're doing all your stuff that you do now, or was it just before that?
Yeah. Wow. They're calling me a backyard lawyer and humanitarian and all sorts of stuff. And they were all laughing, having a joke. And I was like, just so disappointed.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a lot of pain in our community at the moment, because just up the road in Mariba, there was another Indigenous young person shot by police on the weekend. And we've had a couple of protests and marches and things like that. And it does seem to happen more to Indigenous people. And I think it's just because, you know, they get away with it. There's no one standing up for them. And they, a lot of these people, they can't stand up for themselves. Now, this happens to people that are, you know, even white people, if they're experiencing mental health issues or, you know, they can't read or write, I've seen them be really, really mistreated.
Yeah.
And I think it's just because they can get away with it. You know, there's no one there to
hold them accountable. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. And look, as you know, I've been studying law and I'm just about to finish. I'm I've got to apply to the Supreme Court for admission to practice. Hopefully they let me in. But I tell you what, if they do, I'm going to be a thorn in the side of a lot of government agencies, you know, such as police and corrective services. And I look forward to, you know, I speak about and raise awareness for these issues now as best that I can. But, you know, when I have that ability to actually get in there in the courtroom and tell it how it is as somebody that has been there and understood what these people are going through, I mean, I think that's going to be powerful.
Yeah, 100%, man. It's very cool. It's like, it's very, very cool that you've been able to, yeah, put all that negative energy in a container and you know, channel it into something, you know, that can potentially help a lot of people and, yeah, be a real point of difference. It's very cool, mate. So how can people get behind this little campaign that you and others have going on about, I don't know, trying just to get some sort of favorable outcomes with that youth justice reform and not let it go completely out of control, which it probably will. I don't know if you think that, yeah, it's just all going to go through as they want, but yeah, maybe there can be bit of change.
I come up with this idea, which was just to use social media and get a bunch of guys, you know, with that lived experience to say, hey, this isn't a good idea, you know, and just briefly explain why. Really, because I know how powerful lived experience is. I know that the guys that have walked the walk and talked the talk, they know what's going on. They know that it's not a good thing. And, you know, I've reached out to some guys that I know that are pretty big on social media that, you know, have served a lot of time in prison and you know, have managed to change their lives. But really, anybody at all that has been touched, you know, you might be a social worker, you might have worked with some of these young kids, you know, maybe when they were released. You may even be a parent or an auntie, uncle, caregiver, anyone at all that, you know, really has any lived experience at all with really who agrees that people that go to prison, you know, they get out and they're traumatized and they're quite often worse. And at the moment, just sharing those videos around social media. And I've had a few now and they've been really powerful and I'm incredibly grateful because it's raising awareness. There's a lot of people there, you know, that don't know this stuff and they're seeing it and they're thinking, oh, wow, okay, oh, maybe that's why people do offend. Maybe that's, so we're educating people and we're using social media, which is something that a lot of guys that went to prison never had before. You know, no one shared their stories. Nobody wanted to talk to them because they were criminals.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing these guys that were criminals doing great stuff in the communities and people are starting to listen to them. So, yeah, look, if anyone listening or watching, you know, has any experience at all in the system and wants to put together a little 30-second, one-minute video, something that's, you know, easily shareable, just tell us a little about yourself, you know, your name and where you're from and why you think it's not a good thing that we keep building prisons.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you've probably seen some that I've posted on my page as well, my socials. And, you know, incredible stuff. I had John Killick last week. He was, John was most famous for breaking out of Silverwater Prison in a helicopter many years ago. A lot of guys doing incredible stuff. And I'm so grateful. And, you know, there's going to be people that say, you know, you're just a criminal or, you know, lock them up forever. But, you know, those people, we can't lock people up forever.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like if we did just actually lock people up and throw away the key, then okay, maybe we would never have crime. Maybe we would have a crime-free society. But, you know, as long as we are locking people up for periods of time and then releasing them without rehabilitation and support, crime's going to increase and it's going to get worse. It's going to get more serious. So, you know, I'm all about prevention and this is the way that we prevent it.
Yeah, 100%, mate. Look, so awesome what you're doing. Absolutely love it. Thanks for coming back on and sharing, you know, some of the deeper stuff and, you know, the real story. And I think, you know, a lot of people find that challenging to listen to and hear. But the thing that I want to say to people is that, unfortunately, people that, you know, and I know this firsthand just from talking to people, you know, like it's not an uncommon experience, you know, to have fucking deeply traumatic situations and scenarios happen like that. And just the way that getting involved in the criminal justice system fucks people's lives up is absolutely horrible. So, you know, thanks for coming on and having the uncomfortable conversations, mate, and keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah. Look, I've got one more story. You might, you might just want to, you might want to cut this out and I will do something with it later, but there was a young person, right, in New South Wales a few years ago. Now, you used to be able to pay your fines off by going to prison, right?
Yep.
Instead of paying your fine, if you didn't have the money, you could go, look, I'll go do a week in prison or something like that.
They don't do that anymore?
No, and I'll tell you why. This young 18-year-old kid had some speeding fines. He went to prison to pay those fines off for 2 weeks. He was placed into a cell with a very violent offender that tried to rape him. He defended himself and he was murdered. This young person, I can't remember what his name was, but this was in New South Wales in prison. He was killed, and obviously his parents were outraged. You know, his parents are saying, this was our kid, he's 18, he's hasn't hurt anyone, he's done nothing wrong, a couple of speeding fines, and that's why those laws were changed. You know, so stories like this are not isolated. Like, young people go to prison and bad things happen, and fortunately, in New South Wales, you can't do that anymore. There's some other states in Australia where you can still pay your fines off that way.
Yeah.
You know, but whether he was a young person and had, you know, stolen a loaf of bread, or maybe he did, maybe he went into a service station with a screwdriver and got $20, does he deserve to be raped or murdered? And if he is, what happens when he gets out? What kind of person is he going to be?
Yeah.
So, you know, food for thought there. I just thought of it, and I thought that's another powerful story there.
Mate, 100%. That's actually the perfect way to end it, with that terrible kind of case study, because, yeah, that things like that, as I said before, happen more than people like to think. And the more that we can, yeah, have those uncomfortable conversations and bring it out into the open, the more things will change. Hey, everybody, I'll put Shane's Instagram in the show notes. Go and give him a follow and check out all the stuff that he's doing and get involved. I'm sure we'll have you back on for round three soon, mate.
Anytime, thanks, mate. It's always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
No worries. Thanks again. Peace, dude.
Thanks, mate.